Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's that time.
What time?
High time to say, if you've got time to give this time your time, then it's time to let this time spend time making your time a good time on this time.
Monkey Tennis, please, please, cook your eggs. Be safe. Be egg safe. Monkey Tennis,
can I have a glass of water, please?
It falls to me to say he is gone.
Monkey Tennis,
I said I'd find out more. I haven't done that.
Pay for dinner, yeah?
Monkey Tennis,
I said, who the hell is that?
That's merely a shame boy in a wig.
Monkey Tennis,
there is broad agreement that John was good. Tommy, join me at the lady.
The show that promises to be all things.
To all men.
And all women.
And everything in between.
Monkey Tennis,
there's a shuttlecock up there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, where tonight we'll not just be taking a deep dive into the latest episode of This Time, Series 2, but also witnessing the reunion of four podcasters that haven't seen each other for over 6 months, and none of them will be winning a caravan. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Is the apple in our pocket replacing the noodle in our brains?
Nick Alder.
For God's sake, Rosie, you can't eat raw egg.
And Tom Stabb.
It's high time to say, if you've got time to give this time your time, then it's time to let this time spend time making your time a good time on this time.
As you've hopefully already noticed, we are aiming to put our episodes up pretty much as soon as This Time has gone out on BBC One each Friday, so you can start your weekend right with the Allen Monkey Tennis 1-2 double punch. That said, we are not responsible for the behaviour of podcast providers. Sometimes they make promises about getting things live that are not kept. So the best way to make sure you get our episodes as soon as possible and you can have a full hour of Allen-related fun every Friday is to subscribe. So please do that wherever you get your podcasts from, and we'll make sure they go in your inbox as soon as we physically can.
And Adam, I do believe that Apple Podcasts are very much pushing for people to follow, not subscribe anymore. It doesn't make any difference, but I think that might be the word they're going for now. So you can follow, you can subscribe. One of those two things should get you there.
That sounds like you're splitting hairs, Tom.
Splitting?
Send up a smoke signal, send a carrier pigeon, whatever it is, yeah, Apple wants you to do now, please do it.
Obey your Apple overlords, do what they say. Can't stress that enough. Do what Apple say.
As you'll have noticed from recent feedback episodes, we love to hear from all of you. So let me say right at the top of this episode, if you've got any theories, thoughts, complaints or queries about episode one of This Time, or perhaps some predictions for the rest of the series, you can drop us an email, thepartridgepod@gmail.com. Fire us a message, facebook.com/thepartridgepod. Pop off a tweet, Twitter @thepartridgepod. Follow us for a laugh. Instagram @monkeytennispod. Leave us a voice note, Monkey Tennis Hotline 07923 600 017, or shout us a coffee or equivalent donation at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. So, Hard sell aside, we like to start each episode with a little roundup we call This Week in Allen, where basically we take a look at promo bits, trailers, ephemera that's popped up on the internet relating to the episode before we get into the episode itself. So, This Week in Allen, what's happened?
Yeah, I'll get us started with this. So there was an interview with Alan in character on the British Comedy Guide that went live probably about a week or so ago. So if you want to find the British Comedy Guide, they've got the very snappy URL of they are literally comedy.co.uk. So you can't really go wrong with that. So this is an interview with Alan in character, which I just thought is an example of some excellent this time world building and some nice consolidation of some familiar Alan traits. I was going to highlight three things that I particularly liked from this, but I would say it's worth tracking it down and reading the whole thing in full. It's very funny. A couple of quotes from Alan. He says that they underfill the show by about 30% to allow for nattering, so over the half hour expect around 20 minutes of content, and the rest of it is left slack to keep the show fresh. Alan also states it is possible to over-prepare for a show and render it stale. Instead, I prefer to experience parts of the show as a viewer would, which means sometimes I won't really know who a guest is until they come on. And he also talks about the producer being very hands-off, which means he'll leave you to write your own auto-cue or deliver video packages without always running them by him. There are also some choice lines about Jenny, Ruth and Simon, but I don't want to read out all of the gold. But I thought those three quotes in particular were great because that it's just kind of building that world where it makes sense why the VT packages can be insane, why Alan has never prepped. I mean, you know, we know that's we would expect that from Alan going as far back as Naomi knowing you anyway. But I just like them building the world around that and putting it into in-character interviews to kind of give the reason why what we see developing this time can be as slack as it often is.
That's not all. We were also alerted to, I guess, something of a spoiler on IMDb. So I'm going to tread carefully around this. But essentially, there is a, I would say, well-known character from Alan's past that we had kind of flagged to us, was credited on IMDb. So we're not going to name who the character is. We're simply going to say that if you want to see who that character is, you can go on IMDb and see it for yourself. I think it's fair to say that on behalf of the group, we're incredibly excited at the prospect of this character reappearing in the APU. So as I say, we're not going to go into any details as to what it is, but if you want to see it spoiled, head to IMDb and you can see who the character is, and I'm sure you'll agree it's very exciting.
I was just going to say about this, actually. I think from what we've seen, it's actually not clear what episode they appear in either. So obviously they're not in this week's episode, as we know, having now seen it. So it is unclear who this mystery character is. It is unclear, I guess, how and when and why they're going to reappear in the APU. But it is very exciting. But I kind of wish that I didn't know they were going to make a return, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, completely agree. And like Nick says, if you like spoilers, you can have a look, but we're not going to say. But we recommend that you don't go and have a look and just watch the series and wait for that moment to happen. So, we're all very excited about it. And then finally, before we crack on dissecting this week's episode, towards the end of last week, we had a second trailer for this time, which, as we now know, is basically the opening segment pretty much of episode one, which works. I mean, I think we all kind of agreed that what we saw before with Rosie Witter returning wasn't really much of a trailer. It was just a clip, really. But this works a lot better as a trailer than the previous one did. So that kind of helps set up the new series. And I do wonder why they didn't include it as the first trailer, because maybe because of its proximity to the first episode. I don't know, but they didn't want to go too early. But anyway, we got a second trailer, and I think from watching that, I got really, really excited. So, and then obviously transpires, it's the opening scene.
Knowing the world of Alan, the reason that wasn't the first trailer, it probably wasn't ready. They probably hadn't finished writing it by that point. I did enjoy, because so this went up on the BBC Trailers YouTube channel. The comment I enjoyed here is somebody wrote, "If I had no idea who Alan Partridge was, this could have been a legit commercial for a breakfast show." And I thought they make a very good point. It's like, it's done, I'm sure we'll get into this in much more detail imminently, but it's done in such a slick fashion. If you didn't know Alan was a fictional character, you could definitely be like, oh, what's this new BBC One chat show coming my way?
I feel like that's probably a similar tack to the one that they took when they were doing Know Me, Knowing You back in the day as well. I do think initially they presented it as it's just a chat show, and then it was kind of inherent in the trailers or in watching the opening minutes what was actually going on.
What it does show is kind of, and you do get nuggets of this throughout throughout the history of Alan, is that there are times when he is a very competent broadcaster. He can actually deliver lines. You know, the walk and talk is quite a difficult thing to do. You would think, oh, he's actually quite a competent presenter. But obviously we know over the years that that hasn't always been the case. And he does have these momentary, well, regular slip ups and balls ups. But he does have his moments.
I would also say that looking at this episode and previous This Time episodes, the bits where he's relatively slick are the bits where it needn't have been live. So he could have had endless goes at this walk and talk before he actually got it right. That's my feeling, is that when he looks slickest is when he's been able to fluff it 100 times and no one need ever know.
Fair enough.
Shall we break into the episode itself then?
I think now is the time.
Okay. I mean, what I loved initially, straight off the bat, is you've got a very quick fire 15 seconds where there's about 10 gags in a row, mainly revolving around Alan's nasal and ear hair maintenance regime. I like the fact that he describes to Lynn that he's trimming it because it's like bracken. There's a nice reveal that he's actually borrowing Lynn's clippers to do this as well.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's concerned about the smell of burning, but he assures her that it is normal.
I think, as you know, we're all men in our mid-30s. I think we can all agree that this procedure that Alan is going through before the show is absolutely necessary.
When you get to a certain...
I'd say, speak for yourself. I know on record from WhatsApp conversation that Stab and Nick are both advocates of the nasal trimming devices. Not had to go there yet, fortunately. Although I'm sure it's only a matter of time. It's weeks away, probably.
Those tendrils creep ever closer.
Yeah. I'm also experimenting with keeping ear hair in check now as well, which has been fun over the last couple of years.
One little touch that I like here, as Alan starts his little monologue to camera, is the picture of the photo of Ellen MacArthur on the desk, which is a bit of a Gibbons writing trope that Alan is a fan of Ellen MacArthur, because she's mentioned in Oasthouse. I think it's when it's for the Southampton boat show, where he says he wants to go along to see Ellen MacArthur and say, like, great sailing, kiddo. She's a world-class sailor. But I like that it's just like a little nugget for people who are super fans who have perhaps listened to the Oasthouse, that there's a picture of Ellen MacArthur there.
I have to say as well, before we get into the kind of monologue bit that follows, the tooth pin badge, as obviously we know from having seen the trailers and a few promo shots already, so that is firmly in frame here. So, you know, I'm still, I really want to know what it means. And, you know, we got no indication about that during series one. So I'm excited that it is very present in everything we've seen of this series so far, but I am intrigued to see if we'll actually get any kind of revelation at all.
When Alan starts his monologue, there's a little bit in the script that I didn't notice first time that I think is really clever, and just blink and you miss it. And so Alan starts the monologue and he says that he is in dressing room A.
I did clock this. Yeah.
And then
brilliant.
He says that Jenny is in dressing room 1. So it's the guess that Alan has refused to be in dressing room 2. So he's insisted on changing the name to dressing room A. So it's on parity with Jenny.
Yeah, I love that. That's such a nice touch.
That is great.
And yeah, so they get into this sort of Aaron Sorkin style walk and talk, which is great fun. Especially when he's sort of, I mean, part of the reason it works so well as a trailer is not only is it very funny and it indicates sort of, it gives you lots of hints to Alan and Jenny's relationship to one another, but it is also them literally describing the show as well. So it sums everything up very neatly for people that haven't perhaps watched the first series. He talks about the topics they cover as ranging from aqua aerobics to abortion and zebras to Zionism. So I did a quick Google search to see which of these topics beat the other one. Which do you think is more popular on Google Trends UK last 12 months? Is it aerobics or is it abortion?
I reckon abortion. given lockdown, aerobics, right? I think. Yeah. I don't know, but who's searching for aerobics these days? It's quite an 80s term, isn't it? No one says I'm going to do aerobics now, are they?
They're more searching for Bikram yoga and stuff like that.
I don't know if I'm pleased to say it or not, but abortion wins by a landslide. Next question, zebras or Zionism?
Zebras. Surely.
Oh, Nick's on the fence there.
Zebras
less of a hot potato. It's zebras.
Okay, well, one out of two. 50%. That's a pass at GCSE.
Now, one of the things that I loved, and this is a similar kind of a similar thing to the one that Stab just talked about with the dressing rooms, just a very blink and you'll miss it thing, which someone has actually flagged to us, I think, on Twitter as well, which is annoying because I thought I was the only one that spotted it. As part of the monologue, Alan goes through and he names various crew members as he's sort of collecting clipboards from them or pointing to them as he enters the studio. And there are four people in a row that he names. And if you look closely, only one of them is female and she's at the very end of the group of four. Yet the third name that he gives is Shauna. So clearly he's learned their names just to do this link. I mean, in fact, I think there's been a rolling gag about him not knowing what the crew is called.
Yeah.
You know, where like, you know, Psychic Simon will refer to someone in the crew and Alan will have to ask who it is. But yeah, clearly he learned their names for this bit, and because they're, you know, working members of the crew, they've had to shuffle their positions to do some work, and Sean has ended up in the wrong place and it's made him look like an absolute bloody fool.
So yeah, so at this point is when he says, "Hi Nathan, Jermaine, Shauna, Trent." There are so many layers to this tiny, tiny bit of script, because as we discussed, there's no way that Alan casually knows their names. He's had to learn them specifically for this intro. But also there's an inherent joke here about you've basically got four black members of the crew on camera. So it's allowing the fictionalized version of the BBC as a way for them to display that they're covering their kind of diversity needs. But also that is an inherent joke upon itself about how the BBC may or may not do that. Yeah, it's kind of, I can't think of a better way to describe it, but there's kind of like art imitating life, kind of diversity box-ticking nature to that gag there.
I think as well, it's smartly done, because to kind of like prod fun at diversity and inclusion is not a particularly like humorous topic, but what I think they've been able to do is quite smartly deliver a gag that isn't in any way mean-spirited, but at the same time is kind of having a bit of a fun at the BBC, and I think it's very well observed.
I think that's right. It's kind of, it isn't mocking
diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, it's the way that can be overtly displayed to kind of feel like it's a box-ticking exercise. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Right on the heels of that as well, there's something very similar in terms of gender identity, in that there's a rehearsed walk and talk between Alan and Jenny where he says, you know, there's something for every man. And then she's like, and woman. And then he's like, and everyone in between. You know, so again, trying to cover the spectrum, but also giving the impression that he had forgotten to mention women and she had to correct him. And then he sort of, you know, accepts it with a laugh. Like, yeah, the whole thing is just kind of painfully staged, isn't it?
So before we get to the sofa, I was just going to say, I don't know what you guys made of this opening, but when I was sitting there watching this, I was like, okay, wow, this is really slick and professional. Alan and Jenny seem to be like a highly functioning presenting duo at this point. So I guess, you know, I was like, we can only assume that any of the differences between them at the end of season one have been ironed out. And I quite like as well, this kind of tees up to, so at this point, what could possibly go wrong? Which means everything could go wrong from now on.
Yeah, at this point, I was quite excited about my predictor Partridge coming to fruition, which was, you know, Jenny and Alan sort of being on a united front and had kind of put their differences aside and were taking on the role of presenters in a kind of amicable way. But as we'll get to it, maybe it's a little bit for show.
I would say there's the first niggle between them comes within about 15 seconds of the credits rolling. I mean, there's a bit where they're sort of doing their kind of presenter's fake laughter, but then he ruins it. He over-exits it by going, oh, here comes the camera, you know, as if they'd just been having a genuine conversation and forgot they were on telly. And then there's a bit where he goes to her, oh, I thought you did that really well. And then she replies, yeah, and you got your breathing right. Which is also what indicated to me that they've had to run that intro multiple times before they got one they could use. Alan then says that to get into a lady's dressing room at the BBC these days, they're talking about their comparative rooms, you'd have to get in a time machine back to the 70s. But he does also reveal that Jenny has a sign above her mirror that says, never ever compromise, to which I thought, yes, but here we are. with her sat next to Alan Partridge against her will.
Great.
You can't believe that there's been no compromise involved in this situation.
Okay, so there's a couple of things, though, because I don't think we should gloss over this 1970s time machine. I thought this was incredible that about less than 2 minutes into the first show of the episode of this series, they've managed to get essentially a U-Tree / Jimmy Savile gag into the show. I thought that was quite impressive and quite bold, because I think Alan actually says, set the coordinates for 1970s, which, as we know, was good and bad. And I think... Yeah, it's, you know, it's a lot, but the implication is a lot about where that joke lies. And yeah, the never ever compromise, I thought that was great, because that, to me, that feels quite important. Like, they're signposting that Jenny is still as kind of ambitious and ruthless as we thought she was in series one, which kind of seemed to build across the series. So I feel like putting that right in there at the top is kind of waving a big flag saying, don't forget, you know who this character is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I also think it's a bit disarming, or an attempt to be disarming on Alan's part to share that, because it's obviously quite pertinent to Jenny. So the fact that Alan is sharing that on her behalf, I think, is like a subtle disarming move to kind of, you know, showcase her character, because she's obviously a kind of strong, powerful woman, which understandably is probably quite intimidating for Alan, basically, in 2021.
It's sort of him going to the viewers, you know, don't forget that she's ruthless. You know, please don't forget that she's ruthless.
She will stab me in the back.
There's a lovely jab a little bit after that about kids at state schools never getting to run the BBC, which I thought was really interesting. I did try and find out whether anyone who'd been to state school did ever run the BBC. Doesn't look like it. Couldn't find any stats to confirm it either way, but I did think it was strange. The BBC has a website that has a rundown of them all, with sort of like, they're all laid out as if they played Doctor Who, you know, so it's like 13th Director General, you know, so-and-so name. And it really reminded me of Doctor Who. It was like the Director General just continues to regenerate, but it's always a rich white man that was privately educated. So a quick quiz. Do you think there have been more Director Generals of the BBC or Doctor Who's?
Great question.
I think
there have been more DGs.
I reckon there's been more Doctor Who's.
I'm gonna go DGs.
Okay, there are 13 official Doctor Who's. There are 17 Director Generals of the BBC. It's been going a long time. All white men, as far as I can tell.
Brilliant. So
Without context, that sounds terrible.
So what's that? Tom Staff saying, more of that, please. Keep up the great work.
On Diversity Watch, that means that, yeah, Doctor Who's are more diverse than the BBC, but let's be honest, not by much.
I was going to say as well, so much like saying I was impressed they got a yew tree gag 2 minutes into the show, I was further impressed by we're now 3 minutes into the show and they've already got a gag in about the upper management of the BBC as well. Like, you know, they're really like gunning for some quite big targets and kind of like mocking the BBC institution from within, which I just think is quite bold scripting, and fair play to the powers that be in the BBC for actually letting them go along with it, I guess.
Psychic Simon's reintroduced to us at this point. I think Alan throws over to him, hoping he's got a zinger, but he hasn't. As Alan says, always have something ready. I love that. Yeah, Simon's first opportunity to speak is basically mired in his own incompetence.
And you've got two classic things here. You've got on-air coaching from Alan, which we've seen so much and is always funny. And again, Simon's facial reaction, which is always superb.
Probably within 5 minutes here, we've got the first mention of a bombshell, which is a nice throwback to him forever ending episodes of Knowing Me, Knowing You with and on that bombshell, and also his sort of endless quest to have a world first, or to kind of, you know, do something groundbreaking. So he mentions that they're going to be reuniting brothers who've been separated for 60 years, which I think that there's a bit of this in previous This Times as well, where they introduce a concept that's coming up later in the show, and it gives you as the viewer plenty of time to sort of speculate about how that's going to go wrong, and then they add an extra detail as they go, that makes it even more likely that it's going to go wrong.
Yeah, and that's kind of reminiscent of Knowing Me, Knowing You, isn't it? You know, you have him at the beginning saying, of the very first show, we're going to have Roger Moore at the end of the episode, and obviously we know that's probably not going to happen. Hot Pants as well, how's that going to go wrong? What's going to happen there? It's a reliable trope of Alan writing that he introduces something at the beginning and you know it's going to go very badly.
We're talking about haggis now, aren't we? Which, as far as Alan's concerned, is just a fat sheep and porridge sausage.
Yep. Does anyone have haggis?
I like haggis. I like it, but it's kind of like one of those slightly perverse foods, like black pudding. You know, it's like you sort of like the taste of it like you like the smell of petrol, if that makes sense.
Like the smell of petrol? Is that a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing. Haggis, I've had it and it's nice, but the moment you start thinking about what it is, you're like, do I want to eat any more of this?
Yes, to which I would say, who on this group has never eaten a sausage? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, fair point.
I think Lynn re-enters the scene at this point, and she's got a new hip, which according to Alan, makes her like Robocop or Oscar Pistorius.
Brilliant.
Does that mean she's got two fake hips now? Because obviously in I'm Alan Partridge, he says shoot from your hip, your new hip. So is this a second new hip?
Yeah, Must be, right. I mean, and that would explain those references, because obviously both of those people have their legs replaced.
Fully mechanised.
if that's the right way to put it.
Lynn is fully mechanised.
She went for a PVC hip. Alan says he would have gone for titanium because it lasts for years. But then on second glance at Lynn, he says, actually, do you know what? PVC is going to be fine. She hasn't got long to go.
He's done the maths on the age and it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
A couple of other bits in this exchange that I liked. I think it turns out that Lynn has started using bullet points. To which Alan says, I knew you'd like them if you tried them. And there's a note of concern for him because the new producer of this time has come over from E4, which obviously there's a great subtext there about how likely they are to want Alan foregrounded versus Jenny or even Simon at this point. And also, I think they did this deliberately. As they talk about the new producer from E4 and they say change is afoot, they do cut away to an oblivious-looking Simon, which I think is quite deliberate.
I also enjoyed that the concern that he raises about the producer is because there's a waka waka that they've added to the theme tune. That was so kind of like revolutionary and cause to be concerned that he's made the smallest of changes to the intro music. Alan's already panicking about it.
I also just like the shorthand that, you know, a producer, a younger chap from E4, that's the shorthand for like, oh, they're going to try and make this some kind of like youth programming or something. It's just, I think it's... Yeah, the reality of it is probably quite unlikely, but did you guys have a note of the poem or the prose that Alan then cribs after this? I thought this was a brilliant bit of scripting. So there's quite a famous poem by someone called, I'm probably going to absolutely mangle the pronunciation here, by a writer called Martin Niemöller, the best known version of which is, first they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. But of course, Alan's version is, first they came for the theme tune, but I did not speak out because I am not a theme tune. Then they came for the title graphic, but I did not speak out because I am not a title graphic. And then they came for me, and I was cross because I'd taken my eye off the ball. I thought that was so good. Yeah.
I feel like I've heard that poem or versions of that poem in other TV programmes or films or something like that. I didn't know it was a poem and I didn't know who it was by, but I've heard similar kind of
I feel like there are lots of different versions of it that deal around, and it's just kind of, it's quite a common, I think, particularly bearing in mind where a lot of discourse on social media ends up these days. I think it gets quoted on social media quite a lot as well. I had one more note about the Lynn section before we move on. Alan says to her, no one notices you, Lynn. That's what makes you the perfect snooper. I like that because I feel like that ties in quite nicely with Lynn's detective skills that we've seen on display in From the Oast House.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, at this point, it's time to meet our first guest. We are talking body language with Clarissa Hoskin.
Who's written a book with a very snappy title, A Physical Negotiation, How to Get What You Want, A Corporal Survivor Guide. It's Body Language Expert Clarissa Hoskin.
Yeah. I like that Alan kind of suggests that body language is sort of like a science in a weird way, to which she responds, well, no, it is science in a very real way.
There's also a nice little jab back and forth between Alan and Jenny when he's introducing the concept of body language. And he says, yeah, batting of eyelids, sound familiar? To which she hits back about the fact that Alan always has his nap at a certain point in the show as well.
Did you guys get down the list of Alan's body language examples?
Only the one that I think is most prudent, which I believe is whether a divorcee biting her lip when he suggests skipping dessert is a good or bad thing.
Is she anxious or is she intrigued?
I was actually going for the laugh, cry, sigh, scoff, tut and grunt.
It's clear that Jenny is visibly excited by having this guest on, which I guess kind of ties into that message above her dressing room. It's kind of, she's ambitious. This is about body language in a sort of competitive environment. So she's looking to get any tips, or she's looking to get advice on how she can use body language to further her career. I just noticed that she was just very enthusiastic about this guest.
I also enjoyed that the guest was talking about how much she hates when people think they know a little bit about body language, and that obviously reminded Alan that actually he does know a little bit about it. And then we're on to Alan's old instructional video for the Norwich Chamber of Commerce made in 1990, which has got some absolutely incredible production values. The on-screen graphics really made me think of Nickelodeon's Rugrats. It's like the same.
Yeah, bang on. Yeah. I noticed something quite fun about this as well. The computer that's on the desk, nothing there is plugged in. There are just wires just trailing on the floor. Little details like that, I think, really made it. Yeah.
So we kind of see a woman kind of in a hypothetical situation trying to speak to a boss. She's struggling to control a team of five men. And I do like kind of the first tip that we're given. If in doubt, handle and spout in terms of the posture to adopt.
I mean, that's not a thing, is it?
No. That's not even like, that isn't even a thing in the real world that you would ever adopt. Like, if in doubt, handle and spout. You would never communicate in the office like with your hand kind of like bent and your arm kind of on your back.
Okay, so there's some lovely bits in the video. One is when the word rad just appears on screen apropos of almost nothing. And the other is when Alan's script says that basically not keeping eye contact indicates shyness, dishonesty, gypsy or boredom.
So good. I love that. It's a very common Alan trope, a dig against the gypsy community. But I also really enjoyed the fact that grammatically it doesn't make any sense.
So this has been commissioned by the Norwich Chamber of Commerce. So it's good to see that public money has been used to fund such an incredible production. And Alan says it's aged well despite being made in 90, which doesn't even make sense either. Surely you'd say 1990.
There's a lovely
and it hasn't aged well as well.
That's the other point to make there as well. Sorry, it hasn't aged well as
don't
well.
Don't allow that.
A lovely bit when they're back in the studio and they're using one of the sort of supposedly best known instances of body language, which is Sharon Stone with, now depending whether you're Jenny or Alan, that sentence is completed with the phrase either basic instinct if you're Jenny, or if you're Alan, fanny.
Yeah. That got a big laugh from me.
That is great. Yeah, did you guys notice as well, this does come slightly after Susanna kind of testing out the body language, but Alan calls Clarissa Sharon.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice subtle gag, so he's just got Sharon Stone on the mind now. Because there's, basically, you've got the reference about Alan crossing his legs to show a brand of socks on TV, which Jenny calls him out for.
Yeah, great.
And then after Jenny's done her run through and Clarissa's quite impressed, for a moment she uncrosses her legs to compliment her body language. And Alan says, oh, I think you've got a new friend there. I take that back, immediately correcting herself. So that is why he's then got Sharon Stone in his mind from that point.
Some lovely bits where Alan is now giving advice to the expert with his power stance. And again, as Nick mentioned earlier, some incredible grimacing from Simon when they cut away to him. Yeah. They do tend to use Simon quite well to illustrate when Alan's gone off on one. And it's sort of, I guess Simon is a bit of a proxy for the whole crew. Like, they're not going to show anyone behind the camera, but they're all making that face, that sort of Wallace and Gromit, like gritted teeth. Oh, God, it's happened again face.
Two bits of script that I really like. You've got arms, use them. And free chair, you don't need it. Lee.
Yeah, that was great. I also enjoyed the sound of his knees cracking when he's doing that hard run through as well. Just the tone-deaf nature of Alan doing this is exactly what we would expect, but it doesn't make it any less cringy. Totally takes over. And then going like with a hop, skip, jump, bound, power stance, and then the knees.
It had I thought it had a similar feel to when he's trying to explain how you get how you can use the toilet in a train without kind of touching it. It kind of had a bit of physicality to it that he kind of self-narrates as he kind of performs what he's kind of talking through. It just really reminded me of that scene, and I've always enjoyed him doing those kind of things where he just goes off on a tangent. I think it's well performed and it's well scripted.
The paper from series one.
Moving on, there's a development with the twins reunion that he mentioned at the top of the show, which again I think is another invitation to the viewer to work out how this is going to go wrong. It turns out that the premise that's got them both together is that one of them thinks they've won a caravan. Presumably I thought the choice of fake prize may well have been Alan's. We know he's got a fondness for a static home and potentially a hookup for a freebie.
Don't they say that one of them is a fan of caravans?
They do later in the show, right. But I also think that could have been reverse engineered by Alan.
It's also stressed.
Or just a lie.
It's also stressed. It's like mid-range, so it'd be like, imagine a car enthusiast being told that they could come onto a game show where they might win a Mondeo. It's like, is that the hook that you're going to use?
It's time for the sound of silence, isn't it?
Yes.
I like
this. Yes, it is. Yes,
he's off to a monastery. The sort of opening question of this bit is what is silence? Which I thought surely that is a rhetorical question that no one is asking. The answer is very clear. What silence is? It's the absence of sound. He's trying to invent a sort of a desire for knowledge that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think that I don't know. This is kind of more of a sort of an observation on this kind of set piece, because you'll often get these kind of 2 minute, like, or, you know, 2 to 5 minute kind of set pieces, which are kind of him being almost like the roving reporter of the show where he's investigating, you know, a subject. I thought this was an interesting topic to almost look into, because kind of, as you've said, Adam, it's like, well, what's the question you're even really trying to get an answer to? And I did think, just purely from a sort of overarching comedic perspective, I feel like we're about to enter a slightly barren section from even a jokes perspective. I didn't think this was particularly that funny.
Can I just say, I really agree. I think for me, this was probably the low point of the episode, and it's like, it wasn't bad per se. Like, there are still plenty of gags to be found in it, but I think compared to everything else we've seen so far, it just felt quite weak in comparison.
Yeah, and I think quite often the weakest elements of any episode of this time from the first series, for example, were the longer VT sections, in my opinion. But also, I've been thinking about this a little bit from this time and from seeing this section about what this show is, and like, people will probably say, oh, it's not funny or whatever. And I think something that the concept of the show is that it's a pastiche, it's a parody of a TV show. It's not a sitcom. Situation comedy is obviously comedy, you know, situations, that's what it's short for, sitcom. This isn't a sitcom, this is a parody. And I think there is a difficulty in having stuff that is out and outlandish and hilarious and funny and gag, when the conceit of the show is that this is actually a serious VT package for people who are actually at home. So it's, I guess I've kind of, in a weird way, I've kind of made my peace with the VT sections not being massively funny, because then they're staying more true to what the conceit of the show is than trying to be a sitcom, basically, which it's not, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I think it's interesting. So I feel like something we talked about wrapping up kind of series one, in a way, it almost could function like a sketch show, because you could take these individual segments and place them quite individually. But what I feel is interesting, now we're into series two, and I mean, okay, fine, we're only one episode in of six, but feeling like this is one of my least favourite bits, because I'm finding myself already more drawn to the developing storylines we're seeing in the studio.
Yeah,
I think I'm preferring, I mean, again, this is based on one episode, but I'm finding myself preferring the rhythm and the tempo of the script when they're in the studio, and because there is a long drawn out storyline across whatever we're going to see for the next five episodes, I'm already more interested in that, which I think is quite interesting, whereas perhaps there was a bit more of a novelty to having these VT packages in series one and seeing how they play out. And I think, like we're kind of saying, ultimately they always felt a bit flatter than the stuff where Alan's interacting with Jenny, with Simon. So I'm now finding myself, that's what I want to see. I could quite happily have six episodes when it's all in the studio without these VTs taking away. I'd kind of like more of the off-camera conversations and how seeing how these relationships build.
From a writing point of view, I wonder how like writing these sections compares to writing for the stuff in the studio, whether it's more difficult or whether it's easier because it doesn't have to be so reliant on jokes. The jokes can be a bit more subtle, whereas in the studio, I think they have to be a bit more in your face, because that's when it is kind of a bit more like a sitcom, whereas this obviously isn't. So I wonder, as you know, when it comes to writing and the challenge of writing, whether these are easier or more difficult to write for the Gibbons and Steve. But I guess we're kind of digressing a little bit about the episode. But
I mean, yeah, it also doesn't need to move the narrative forward, so perhaps there's a little less pressure on these scenes. But like you say, they are somewhat boxed in by the conceit of the show as well. So he asks what is silence, and he talks about the prospect of silence becoming so scarce that you'll be able to swap 1 hour of silence for a bike. I did try to look up whether anyone had paid for silence, and let me tell you, those are some of the grimmest search results of the year for me. Never search for paid for silence. Some horrendous stories out there.
I would say, to kind of bring it back to kind of the comedy then, what I did really enjoy about this is Alan's injured his hand as a result of this, as a result of visiting the monastery, so he has to leave a day early and then basically drives off to It's My Life.
Yes. Yeah,
and the use of that song I thought was a great little Easter egg level joke for the hardcore Alan fans, because we know that that song is on his walking playlist from Nomad, for example. Yep. So on a surface level, it's just a comedic song choice because it's kind of blaring out of his car off the back of a piece about silence. But if you're fully invested in the APU, that really has a great payoff, I think.
A couple of things that I did like from this piece, from this section, were the specifically the line, "It occurred to me, God, all-knowing, invisible, and all around us is identical to high-speed Wi-Fi." And then I thought the bit around in the cathedral was quite reminiscent of Alan in the Norwich Cathedral cloisters, which I thought was a nice little comparison there. And I did enjoy the no running and jumping, slow-mo jump bit where Alan then turns into Christ on the cross.
Yeah, some bits that I really liked about this. He talks about the fact that young Christians are often banging tambourines, and in the confusion you end up believing in God. There's a really great bit when he's talking about silence and his inability to leave silence on screen because of the BBC guidelines that mean that you have to have a noise every minute or so, and also that he's been told that BBC One viewers need constant noises to keep them occupied. There's a little bit about premeditated farts that's quite funny as well.
Yes.
And also there's a bit where basically when he's doing the running and jumping stuff, he's in a hoodie, and you can tell that that's literally all he's got in his own wardrobe that is approximating robes. Like, that's the closest thing he's got, is putting on like a beige hoodie.
I thought that was quite interesting. That's a Warwick University hoodie, which I thought was quite an interesting choice. I couldn't really work out what the gag is there, apart from the fact it's probably what you'd not expect. Couple of other bits that I liked at the beginning of this piece, when Alan says, "Don't worry, these men aren't ignoring me, they're monks," implying that they can't reply to him saying good morning. But I thought, obviously, the great joke is there. Fine, they can't say hello, but they could acknowledge him, but they literally don't. They are ignoring him.
There's a sort of creeping theme around the monk's rudeness towards him, isn't there? I quite like that. They're supposed to be like very peaceful and very centered, but they're all pissed off with him.
Yeah, even though he's just arrived. Like you were saying, the bashing of the BBC One audience I thought was great. That, BBC One viewers are thought to benefit from content with frequent noises. And the bit about the farts, I did really want to add this in. So he talks about farts being involuntary unless preceded by da-da-da-da-da-da. Now, I have to go back to childhood days here. Now, I feel that is missing something slightly. I had a couple of friends that used to do literally that that kind of preceding noise, but with this line, "Listen to this, too good to miss, da-da-da-da-da-da." So I think that'd have been much better. So listeners, do feel free to use that with any or premeditated farts going forward.
Or if you have any stories about how your friends preempted some farts at school, get in touch on the Monkey Tennis Hotline.
That's nice.
This is the kind of highbrow content that we're known for.
Just to quickly touch on a point that you mentioned there, Tom, where he's wearing a...
Is this about farts?
I'm moving it on from farts, I'm afraid. The Warwick University hoodie. I'm almost surprised, like, I would have Alan Down as someone that would buy, like, university apparel to make himself look more intelligent. Like
Oxford or Cambridge, yeah, or something.
A Harvard University hoodie or Oxford University hoodie. So I don't know how much of the gag is. He's just bought a hoodie from a uni he didn't go to appear intelligent, but he's chosen Warwick as opposed to going in straight at the top.
A couple of final things from this. I like that he refers to the year as 2008, and he's talking about 2008. And also he does this thing that we enjoy sometimes where he sees someone and then tries to wildly speculate about their past. Mm. So some of the monks, he's like, perhaps this monk used to be in D Ream, but his life became an nightmare and he decided to become an unk. And then just the soft I want unk is an absolutely beautiful touch. I really liked it. And then I think they cut to another one where he's like, I don't have any thoughts about the past of this monk. I just included him for no
suddenly,
reason.
Suddenly, this section is brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. I also enjoyed that he says, smiling constantly can begin to make your face ache. I wondered if it felt the same for Holly Willoughby, which I really enjoyed. So I did Google Holly Willoughby images, and I thought
I'd play a little one question quiz.
Yeah, that has been a real hardship for you, Adam.
A one question quiz for you. True or false, the first 20 images that appear when you Google Holly Willoughby are of her smiling.
True.
Gotta be true.
It's actually false. You've got 16 smiling, 2 forlorn, 1 confused about a plant, and 1 concentrating on an instruction to her earpiece. But yeah, the vast majority are very cheerful.
Cheerful.
Yeah. There are broad agreement that Holly Willoughby is cheerful.
I love the physical comedy of Alan trying to get this tray of plant pots out of the door and monks basically just fronting him at every turn.
He's getting properly mugged off here, isn't he?
Absolutely.
Or monked off.
The monks
he's
are
getting
cruel.
Monked off.
But again, for me, I felt like that gag played out a bit too long. Like, there were so many different iterations of the same joke. It's like 1 or 2 would have been fine. They still would have made the point.
Mm. It's perhaps a little like the one every episode Ruth Duggan disagreement gag that ran through the first series. Mm. I know that obviously had variations and there's a bit more to it, but that did feel like it perhaps didn't vary enough over 6 episodes in series 1. We're back in the studio, and I think we're talking about addiction to tech. I thought Alan's example was worth digging into, because he describes that people's addiction to tech has resulted in a cab driver struggling to work out the change from a £20 note for an £18 fare. He's like, clearly the change is £2. I think probably what's caused the driver to pause here is that Alan wants that £2 back and isn't offering it as a tip.
You know what? I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Very
because
good.
It, the way he tells that, that's definitely something that's happened to him, isn't it? Yeah.
And yes, so he asks, as we used as a quote at the top of the episode, is the apple in our pocket affecting the noodle in your brains? Which also is sort of nonsense that seems to make sense, because your noodle is your head, so the brains are in your head, not the other way around. You can't have it's not a noodle in your brains, is it? So again, it doesn't stand up to even basic scrutiny.
I think it's important, before we get to the digiwall, I'll give you guys the breakdown here. It takes Alan 14 steps to get there. That's 10 seconds of screen time. And there are a full 4 seconds of silence after Alan has finished Simon's intro into the script. So again, in terms of real life TV, 14 steps, 10 seconds, that is an eternity. It's absolutely brilliant. Love it.
Simon Denton has an expanded role to include live calls, and I've just made the note, yeah, that's what he needs. more responsibility, although crucially the same.
Finally got that promotion, Mark. Yeah.
The tweets come through to at this time show. I believe we covered this in series 1, but that account does exist. I think they've pretty much set it up in order to avoid copycats.
It gives you a nice little reveal when they must have been filming some of these. So this one about picking up the broken glass with bread, that is a real tweet that you can find, and I think it's dated the 25th of November. So that, if you really want to dig into the detail, there are a few other tweets that you can find as well, and obviously we don't yet know what they relate to, so that'll be interesting.
It's good to see that the time between series 1 and series 2 has been spent getting familiar with the digiwall.
It
becomes clear at this point that Simon has basically misunderstood the brief. And therein lies the gag. So we weren't supposed to be getting kind of... I think Simon had kind of like asked if we'd lost good old-fashioned kind of common sense rather than kind of like asking the bigger question around sort of our reliance on technology. So yet again, Simon has got this wrong.
Yeah, because Alan's thinking was more, have we lost something in society? Simon somehow is basically converted that to housekeeping tips.
Yep.
He wanted Alan's deep bath sponsored by Dettol, and you've got Simon's shallow shower, basically, haven't you?
Did you guys spot all the sweet and or chocolate wrappers coming out of Simon's pocket when he has to panic with a phone call?
No, I didn't. That's great.
Yeah, just a great noise to hear on live telly.
So in order to access the calls, he has to go calls, then live, and then there are three phones on the screen. He gets out the pee paper and just goes, I'll just put phones.
That made me laugh so much. Like the look of like genuine panic, fear and confusion all at once. I've just put a phone. So good.
I also had some sympathy as well, because that is not Simon's fault, is it? That is the designer of the Digiwall's fault. Putting three phones on the screen, and he's got to just pick one and hope it's the right one.
Yeah. I loved it when Simon is actually making minor breakthroughs with the Digiwall, like his level of excitement and glee. So when he's finally figured out what he needs to do, he says, come on then, what's all the fuss about now? Let's go, come on, let's travel. I love like the kind of overcompensation when he's finally getting something right. That really tickled me.
Yeah, and I just really like the comedy timing and the way that it flowed when he works out that it's not Stephen Tent on line 4, it's Stephen Fort on line 10, and they get through to him and he hangs up.
He's gone.
Yeah. The comedy timing of the hang up was very good. Yeah.
And then Alan's kind of like, have we lost our common sense? You've sort of answered that question. Yeah. So it turns out that there's some unused Comic Relief glitter cannons lying around that Alan wants to let off for the twins' reunion. I thought this was really good because it's the return of Glitter and Alan, which have obviously mixed well in a Dantes of Reading session in the past. And also, it's more fuel to the idea that the twins' meeting is going to be a backfiring anticlimax of some kind. And it also refers back to Alan's kind of dalliances with Comic Relief that we've covered on a previous episode. So there's a lot going on
or
there.
Or even dealing with White City pyrotechnics in Knowing Me, Knowing You. What could possibly go wrong with this? In this little section with Lynn as well. So Lynn's telling Alan that the new producer seems pleased and has given Jenny a thumbs up. And I really like, obviously, when you read between lines, that probably is good news for Jenny, but not good news for Alan. I think that's where that's leading to.
And speaking of things that are not good news for Alan, Ruth Duggan's back. Lolly Adefope as Ruth Duggan with a segment on the third Heathrow runway. I mean, it's essentially kind of extending the joke from series one, but I do feel like they put some more effort into kind of adding some flesh to the bones of this joke.
Yeah, now. I was pleased it was a bit different. It's a similar conceit, but the execution is different. And I also love that when Alan says hi to Ruth and she doesn't even respond at the start of this section, so immediately they've signposted that relationship hasn't got any better. But I think for me, I would say these bits are definitely cleverly scripted, but I just don't feel like they add very much. It feels a bit too much like a retread. And actually, his interaction with Ruth always feels quite kind of overly performative for me. So it just, I don't know, there's just something about them that it just, I could live without it, I think, is what I'm saying.
I think a lot of people, when we were doing feedback for Series 1, when they revisited a section with Ruth, people were saying, oh, it's just a repeat of the gag. And obviously the point, again, the conceit of the show, that you're going to have returning sections, you're going to have returning sort of roving reporter sorts of things, given what the show is. And I kind of do understand that, but I really liked this section. I thought it was really good. I we're completely on Alan's side on this, I think. Like, I don't know if I'm speaking for the rest of the group, but like Ruth is really unprofessional towards him if this was real or whatever. But she would be reprimanded, you would think, for her unprofessional behaviour. But I just really like the ending of it where Ruth says, you know, this it could have implications for thousands. And then Alan just goes, thousands of what, Ruth? Chairs?
Yeah.
Beans?
Cats?
Grapes? Crabs? Oh, people. Right, okay, sorry, just wasn't clear. And then signs off.
Yeah, sorry. And then he's like, yeah, sorry, that's the 64,000 brackets dollar question.
But yeah, I just really like, I kind of like the back and forth and like the kind of jousting that they do together. I actually quite enjoy it, even though I kind of do understand that it is a bit of a repeat gag.
Yeah, I find it, I think I'm more of the opinion that it is a little bit repetitive. And I also don't always sort of see the Gibbons as wanting to retread ground. So I'm in some respects surprised that they have done that. What I will say is a positive for it, though, is that I do think it's a nice balance so that Alan isn't like the butt of the joke the whole time. I think it balances it out slightly because, as you say, Ruth is kind of being unprofessional here and Alan is, you're on his side essentially because she is making things difficult. So I think it's a nice balance between not making him, you know, the butt of all the jokes. It kind of gives gives him a little bit of extra kudos in the eyes of the producers and, you know, audiences, but also in the eyes of the viewers that are actually watching this as fans of Alan.
I wonder if we're going to get a Dave Clifton moment in this series with Ruth when Alan finally has the end, gets to the end of his tether with Dave Clifton on in I'm Alan Partridge Series 1 and he just goes, oh, fuck off, like that. I wonder if we're going to have a culmination where Alan just maybe loses it and like the facade drops with Ruth because he just can't take it anymore because she's being so making life so difficult for him.
And that's interesting, actually, because obviously a big kind of plot point with Series 1 is him and Jenny losing it with each other, or him more losing it at Jenny. So it's interesting because I think an easier route would have been for him and Ruth to really lose it at each other in quite an audible way. So yeah, that's interesting.
Speaking of returning characters, did anyone else expect Sam Chatwin, played by Simon Barnaby, to be back this time? I genuinely thought he was probably out of it for good.
I did love though when he enters on, he's like, hello you horrible lot. I don't know, there's something about Sam Chatwin that I do want to. He's kind of like horrible, but I actually do quite like him.
I think it's played very, very well, like the attention to detail in the script and how the character is and stuff like that. It's very well played, and he is a believable character, I think, like as someone who returns to the show and is kind of like, oh, you know, the love and the warmth that I have. Like, he's really smarmy and really cheesy, but it's very
smarmy,
well played.
Smarmy is the word.
Yeah, it's very well played and very well written, I think.
I think he brings that sort of, I don't think he's been typecast at all, but I think he brings that sort of charisma to his role in Detectorists as well. That kind of like, that sort of smarmy assumption. And also, if anyone's not seen it before, I really recommend a Warp Films production called Bunny and the Bull, which he's in along with Noel Fielding and various other people. It's like a kind of part animated, part sort of like, not intellectual, but kind of like, it's like a sort of headspace drama, and it's just a brilliant film. And he's one of the main roles in that.
Just whilst we're doing a quick recommendation, a tangent here, I was going to say, with the actress that played Clarissa Hoskin, that was an actress called Layla Farzad. She is in I Hate Susie, which was a Billy Piper kind of drama from last year. She plays Billy Piper's agent in that show. If you guys haven't seen that, I highly, highly recommend it. It's really funny, really creative. Like, every episode kind of tells a kind of different story in a different way. Both Leela and Billy Piper are fantastic in it. So if we're doing adjacent recommendations, do add that to the list. I hate Susie.
Did anyone notice Alan swap T's for D's when Sam comes in and says, oh, I've got some stuff to give to you, and he gives out the book and stuff like that, and Alan says, I've got stuff to give to you from the dressing room, like a bottle of water.
I did like that he kind of goes into panic mode at that point, doesn't he? So he's like, feels like he has to match Sam in front of the audience. He's like, yeah, I've got a couple of towels, some bottles of water, 12 egg sandwiches. Again, returning to his kind of like his love of egg, or although he does say 11 after he's had one. What I really enjoyed though, he ends that sentence with, which he says, got 12 egg sandwiches, which he says, I'm happy to throw at them. So it's like throw at the audience. Like, I can imagine Alan enjoying throwing egg sandwiches at a BBC studio audience.
And he follows that by throwing a mug at an audience member. There's quite an audible thud after that happens, and you can see other audience members are looking very concerned.
Spotted that, great.
Nice. I guess probably arguably one of the first genuine bombshells of the series. Did anyone see this coming, that Sam and Jenny are dating?
Not at all.
No. So quite
seems an odd match.
I think that's half of the joke, because Alan could obviously draw, you know, direct comparisons to, you know, their age. So the fact that it is such a kind of shock gives obviously some sort of fuel to the gag. But no, I never saw this coming.
Did you love how awkward and cringe inducing as well when Alan is basically stuck in a handshake with Sam while Sam and Jenny are in a very long loving embrace as well? That was so awkward to watch.
And as Alan says, you make a cracking couple, and the thing is, I actually mean it.
Yeah, because they've got contrasting hair colours, they've got a height difference, and Sam has public school confidence, making up for any shortfall that Jenny might have.
Yeah, which I thought tied quite nicely into the fact that she's got that never ever compromise sign in her dressing room. Like, she's sort of, you know, she's had to really fight to get here, whereas Sam has coasted on like his family connections.
Well, he's the son
of BBC
Factual Programming, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
I did put in my notes here, I wonder, is Jenny going to let comments like that slide, or is she going to explode at Alan in this series? Because I think, you know, fine, we're only one episode in, but there have been a few instances where you think the Jenny that we already know surely at some point she's going to flip on him if he keeps on making little barbs like that.
So Sam Chatwin is the host of a BBC One travel show called A Sense of Place. That's what he's here to talk about. There's a really nice bit when they come off the back of a bit of a clip of the show where Alan is describing Sam as Britain's best loved TV presenter. I mean, even a beginner to the APU will know that he can't possibly mean this. He's not going to rate Sam above himself. And so it transpires that he's like, Sam's like, oh God, yeah, where did you get that from? And he's like, oh yeah, it was taken from your website. And then don't they describe, I can't remember if they speculate about other travel shows. They sort of try, like to imagine other travel shows that could happen with celebrities.
It's episodes of that show. Yeah, do you have the list?
Yes,
there are three.
Do you want to go for it? Yeah, I've got the list here. Well, actually
four, technically. Yeah.
I've got all four. So it's kind of it's almost like a double-handed joke where he talks about the celebrity and where they're going to go, and then there's a kind of like a payoff with Alan's reaction. So the first one is Giant's Causeway with Jensen Button.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah. Second, Balmoral with Morgan Freeman.
I'd love to see that.
I'd love to see that.
North Wales with Amanda Holden.
So the next one.
There's the gag.
And then finally, Jenny and Sam go to Reykjavik. I must admit, out of that list, I probably would pick Balmoral with Morgan Freeman. I would definitely watch that.
Feels like a Bank Holidays retread again, doesn't it, as well?
Yeah, it does, actually. But I was going to ask a question to the group. What is your favourite place?
With a celebrity.
Oh, yeah, actually, yeah, you can probably pick a celebrity as well. Why not? Go nuts. I'm happy to start. I think I would go to the National Football Museum with John Barnes. I've been there. It is a great place. There's a lot of history. You can learn a lot. And it's in Manchester. So just stay out in Manchester with John Barnes.
Okay,
like
so for the purpose of the travel show concept, you're going to Manchester with John Barnes. That's how the show works.
All right, then. I'm going to go to Italy with Claudia Winkleman.
Great.
Better. Oh, yeah, will she be buying extra luggage allowance for that fringe?
No, she doesn't need to. She can travel light because the fringe protects her from the sun.
I would go to Hawaii with Sophie Ellis-Bextor. I think she'd be quite a lot of fun, and I've always wanted to go to Hawaii. So yeah. Sophie, I'm on Twitter. Just message me. We can go. We'll make it happen.
I think I'd probably. Putting myself on the spot, I'm going to go for a weekend in Barcelona, and I'm going to take Ana de Armas with me so we can figure out when that bloody Bond film is going to come out.
Very nice. I'm taking Griff Rhys from the band Super Furry Animals to the Isles of Scilly for a little mumble and a ramble.
No. I don't think you've understood the concept of the game, Adam. you've chosen a man.
you've got it wrong.
That's fine.
Just a quick thing on North Wales with Amanda Holden. I thought that worked on two levels. That's obviously a dig at Amanda Holden, but possibly, particularly from Alan's point of view, a dig at North Wales as well, right?
Yeah, I think it's matching someone he doesn't like, probably with a location.
With a place he doesn't have an interest in, yes. Yeah.
In terms of sort of acting nous in this episode, I really enjoyed the moment, obviously, Sam produces the book and gives one over to Jenny, and she opens it and it's blank, and he's like, oh, is it? And she opens the page to the ring, and you see Alan or Steve clock the ring. In terms of how he reacts to that, you see him visibly deflate, and I just really like that as a note, because obviously Alan is so excited about this twins bit. He thinks it's going to be great television, and he knows in that moment that he's been usurped, and you just by not only by the moment but by Sam as well, and you just see him visibly deflate, and I just really like that as a touch.
That's great, isn't it? But because it's not even about Jenny and Sam getting engaged, it's about it's ruined his bit of TV moment.
Yeah.
It's because it's ruined his moment of TV glory. That's why he's deflated, yeah.
And also it comes hot on the heels of him kind of, you know, being quite stern and getting a bit of a one-upmanship on Sam, where Sam's kind of like, oh, the welcome I always get when I come back here. It always feels like home, to which Alan goes, I live here now.
Yes. And
I
thought, yeah,
that's absolutely his I am the danger, I am the one who knocks from Breaking Bad. That's basically Alan's equivalent of that.
Yeah, that was really great.
Another little script section that I liked on this is when Alan goes, what a wonderful way to end that section. Not the episode, not the show, just that section.
Another bit I particularly enjoyed was he just really slams Sam's book down on the sofa. the way he kind of like passes it across and slams it down, that just really, really tickled me. And just the kind of enforcing of the class divide between Sam and Alan. Sam kind of representing the establishment and the top layers of the BBC, going on summer holidays to Kenya or Kenya, versus Alan going on holiday in Anglesey and doing jigsaws. I like the way they're kind of, they're setting up them at kind of opposite ends of the spectrum like that.
Sort of flowers are brought out. There's colossal congratulations from Alan. Good use of that word again from the Alan lexicon. And what I enjoyed is the confetti cannons are fired as well. And obviously Lynn is deploying the confetti cannon. So either Lynn has fired them at the wrong time, or I'm wondering if Lynn is kind of overwhelmed with joy at the fact that Jenny is engaged, that she's just forgotten when she should be firing them, just thinks now is the moment and fires out the confetti cannons to help celebrate it.
I'm not sure that Lynn is a fan of Jenny, so I don't know if she would be excited for her getting. I think she'd be more annoyed that she's usurping Alan's moment, because as we know, what's good for Alan is good for Lynn.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I don't know.
I think what would make sense in the universe of the show is somebody on the studio floor has seen the confetti cannons, witnessed the engagement happen and gone, oh, that's what the confetti cannons are for. I don't think Lynn's triggered them. I think
you're
Lynn was
right,
waiting in the corner like a mouse for the end of the show and hasn't been able to get to them in time.
In all of this melee, or just before this happens, there's also a nice little exchange where Sam is trying to talk about the book that he's releasing of the series and how the book is very much its own thing, distinct from the TV series. And then Alan basically makes him read out the title, which is just like, yeah, it's the same as the TV series. It's based on a TV series called the same thing with him from the TV series. I enjoyed that a lot. And I do think that happens a lot in publishing, doesn't it? Like when things end up being tied into successful films, and they have to like change the jacket to look like the film poster and all of that kind of stuff.
I'd also like to just add in this section, I think the line that probably made me laugh out loud the most in watching this episode was when Jenny gets Alan to smell the flowers. He goes, smell these, and he goes, nice. It's like he's so annoyed, but still trying to react positively. Just like two words, but just the way he acted that just made me laugh so much. I can't believe it.
Yeah, is it time to kind of wrap to the sort of final frantic scene of the show?
The failed surprise, yeah.
This I like this because this is another, I think, a good example of the Gibbons and Steve giving you tidbits throughout the show that let you think it's going to go a certain way. You know, you think that this story is going to get the full amount of airtime it deserves, and that one of the twins will hate the other one, or that he'll punch Alan because he was promised a caravan, or, you know, all the things that we could have envisaged happening are not what actually happens.
Yeah.
I also like that it's quite reminiscent, the way that he has to now kind of rattle through the story of these twins in about 10 seconds is very like his recounting of Bond in the static home after everyone's getting Bond wrong.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of like just his sort of frantically trying to run through all the details in time.
I really enjoy choice.
And sounding a bit Chinese.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the choice lines of where is he, bring him out, and clap him now, all of which combined with a kind of Chinese delivery style.
Cash in hand, pay no tax.
That's the way, and he signs off the whole thing with gonna cry, no, all right, goodbye, terrible television. He's so crestfallen that it's gone
fade
so
to
badly.
Black.
Yeah.
And that's the episode.
Yeah.
What are everyone's general thoughts about the return of Alan? I mean, I personally feel like they've addressed a lot of the things I wasn't so keen on in this time. I think they're bringing back recurring characters in the right kind of a way. I think it feels like there's more of a narrative thrust. It feels like there's more attention paid to the off air, quite in air quotes, sections of the show. So there's a little bit more that's kind of down the I'm Alan Partridge route, rather than all being down the kind of Knowing Me, Knowing You, it's all happening live, going out broadcast. And I think that's only a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really enjoyed this episode on first viewing. I think I've really enjoyed the way they've built all the character interactions so far. I think it's a luxury they have that they're now onto series two. That means you can bring everything we've seen from series one, the previous six episodes, to build the narrative and the character interactions and the character arcs, which just makes ultimately a richer show for us for series two, hopefully. But yeah, I think first episode felt very strong on the whole, really enjoyed it. Like I say, even the bits that weren't my favourites were still funny and had a lot of gags. So, ultimately felt really great.
Yeah, I would just say that I think more of the same would often feel like a negative, but actually in this context, I would definitely say it as a kind of positive. I think that they're able to take a format and breathe new life into it whilst making it feel familiar, and changing just enough about it that it's retained what I liked about the first series, but actually found kind of new things to kind of develop. My only small thing is, as we've mentioned, and we don't need to sort of cover it anymore, was just the sort of outside VT sections. I'm curious to see how they pan out and, you know, do they get stronger? Like, just more once we get to episode 6 and we're able to look back, I'm just curious to how those VTs play out.
Yeah, I mean, a strong first episode, and I think you guys have pretty much covered all the points that I would make, and I kind of echo them. But I think one thing that, you know, Adam kind of touched on this in the first series, where it's good that right from the beginning we've got the start of a potential arc that could last for the whole series, this relationship between Jenny and Sam. How is that going to develop? What's going to happen there? Is that going to last the duration? Is Alan going to get involved in some way in splitting them up? Like, you know, he somehow finds out some information that puts a spanner in the works of their relationship. So I am a big fan, like Adam is, of in shows like this having a narrative arc that can run through the series. And I think this is a good place to start, and I'm excited for the potential that it has.
So before we go, there's the small matter of our predictor partridges. Those of you that listen to our feedback episodes recently will know that we all each predicted a couple of things, or one or two things, that we thought would happen in this first episode. Let's see how we did. In short, badly. I hedged my bets with two predictor partridges. I said a dog will be seen either in VT or live on set. Don't believe that's happened. And I said that the origins of Alan's tooth lapel pin will be revealed. Well, although we did see the pin, there were no further clues about what its purpose is. So that's zero on both counts. Tom Stab said that Jenny and Alan will unite against a common foe. I would argue we didn't see that happen, really. So. Tom Dark, I think, has hedged his bets as well with something that was probably 50-50 whether it would happen or not. We will not see the pandemic referred to in any way. Well, that has happened, so congrats.
Yeah, I mean, I did kind of cheat there just based on the press shots we'd seen alone. They were far too close for that to be like social distancing, but yeah.
Yeah. And Nick said that we would hear from Denise and or Fernando. Sadly, not even a mention of them so far. I've got a feeling Denise and Fernando, their comic potency relies on them never being seen. I don't think we'll ever see them in the APU. I think they're like Maris in Frasier, or they're like the truth about the camping trip in Gavin and Stacey. Like their comedy comes from their absence. And I think to shine too big a light on them might spoil it.
Absolutely just pissed on Nick's chips on Christmas Day there, haven't you?
Well, maybe just to, you know, just be clear, it's the reference that they had in I think episode 3 of series 1 of This Time, where it's a passing reference about, you know, having coffee in my favorite Starbucks in my favorite seat with my, you know, that's a reference to his daughter. So I completely agree, you're never going to see them as characters, but more references to them within Alan's life was kind of what I was pitching for. But either way, it hasn't happened, and I can accept that, Adam.
There we go. Fair enough. Congratulations to Tom Dark, then, the victor of Per Predictor Partridge. And we would obviously love to hear your thoughts about this episode now that it's out in the wild. I mentioned them at the top of the show, but you can email us thepartridgepod@gmail.com, facebook.com/thepartridgepod, with Twitter @thepartridgepod, Instagram @monkeytennispod. Leave us a voice note, why don't you, on the Monkey Tennis hotline, 07923 600 017. They're probably our favourites to receive, and we do like to put them in future shows as well. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, for free, you can go to ko-fi.com/monkeytennis and shout us the price of an individual cup of coffee, which will be pennies in each of our pots, or why not go whole hog and get us all one, and we'll be forever grateful and maybe even read your name out on a future episode. So we'll obviously be back next week. We've got 5 more episodes of This Time to go, and we're very excited to cover them for your listening pleasure. Please do subscribe if you can, and then you'll make sure you get our episodes as soon as This Time goes out on BBC One. Until next week, thanks from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast. And goodbye.
Bye.
I wonder if Amanda Holden would want to go to the Football Museum with you and John Barnes, Tom. It's my life.
Around your business, take a trip to East and West. You find that you don't know anything. Everybody's getting tired of you. Sometimes you have to.
It's that time.
What time?
High time to say, if you've got time to give this time your time, then it's time to let this time spend time making your time a good time on this time.
Monkey tennis? Please, please, cook your eggs. Be safe. Be egg safe. Monkey tennis?
Can I have a glass of water, please?
It falls to me to say he is gone.
Monkey tennis?
I said I'd find out more. I haven't done that.
Pay for dinner, yeah?
Monkey tennis?
I said, who the hell is that?
That's merely a shaved boy in a wig.
Monkey tennis?
There is broad agreement that John was good. Tommy, join me at the lady.
The show that promises to be all things.
To all men.
And all women.
And everything in between.
Monkey tennis?
There's a shuttlecock up there.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.